many points of view and a lot of information that we need to dig in. So this is a big part of it. Can I just totally separate? For those of you who have the headsets, could you please hold on to them, especially over lunch? Do not put them back into the central thing, so that just please hang on to them. And at the end, you will return them at the end of the day, okay? Makes it a whole lot easier and cleaner and all that kind of stuff. Richard is coming. I see him coming. All right. Do we have roving mics? Or just at the end? I know there are going to be a couple of people at the end of the day with roving mics. We do not have roving mics. We do not. We'll do it this way for the time being. Or, in other words, just among yourselves, but the point was also to have an open discussion. Do any of you have questions that you can speak loud enough? Oder egal, welche Sprache, nicht? Haben Sie Fragen? Des questions? Vous pouvez des questions? Vous pouvez poser des questions en français aussi, hein? Yeah. What she's asking is, I think, correct me if I heard it correctly, so with respect to the debt-based system and sustainability, the necessity for growth, what are the impacts? Is that?
Well, I'd be happy to respond briefly. There is, of course, a link between the financial system and the pressures on the environment. If we have unnecessary growth and wasteful growth and harmful growth, then that's bad. And very often that is driven by a financial system that is purely profit-oriented and driving for growth and returns for shareholder value maximization. And that is the problem when you have financial institutions that are owned by profit-oriented shareholders. And that's why I think a solution is actually to have more not-for-profit banks. And among the international banks, I think the not-for-profit stakeholder banks, Genossenschaft Bank and Volksbank Raiffeisen, also in Canada, Jardin, and all sorts of cooperative banks have a better track record. They lend for green projects, carbon footprint reduction, investments, because they have more long-term investment horizons, patient capital, because for these green projects, often there are returns, and often very safe, but over a long time period and a bit low and a bit meager for the red-blooded, profit-maximizing financial institutions. So that's why it's important to keep that in mind. And there are different types of banks, and we should encourage and support the not-for-profit stakeholder banks, also for environmental reasons. They have an excellent track record. In Germany, there's been much more investment in the green economy, say, compared to the UK, and it's largely down to the banking system. Five big banks have no interest. They don't give these long-term loans at interest rates that would be viable. But in Germany, they do that because they're stakeholder banks, 1,500 of them.
Anyone else would like to comment on that?
I've got a lot of sympathy with what Richard is saying, but it's always more complicated than that. So I think there does need to be more reliance on these sort of smaller, locally based whatever. But having said that, then you get back into these governance questions, and I would just put it to you that here in Switzerland, back in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, it was the Cantonal banks that got into a lot of trouble. We know that in Germany, a lot of the banks have made some really sort of silly investments. They were referred to by the investment community as those stupid Germans who were prepared to buy all sorts of subprime stuff without really questioning what was in it, because I guess they were too trusting because their system worked. So the questions, and the political influence in many of these small banks is very, very large, and that's the way they like it. So when you get into this, you want to think about governance questions in a very serious way as well. So I agree with the broad thrust of what you're saying, but I think there's there's some nuances there that are actually quite important.
There's a big misunderstanding which needs to be cleared up. You're talking about the Landesbanken, which I suppose would be similar to Kantonalbanken, only bigger in Germany. But they're not the banks I'm talking about. They're, of course, big banks, and they behave like big banks, big bad banks. I'm talking about the 1,500 local community banks. They're very small. They've never been in trouble. In the 200-year history, not a single one has gone under. Public money has never been used to bail out any of them. And they account for 70% of deposits in Germany. And they're the ones I'm talking about. The ones you're talking about are the big banks, and I agree, they are the problem. One should solve the problem that they get public funds and they get supported. It's the community banks, the small banks, that have been doing sound banking by lending for productive investments. They need to be encouraged, but the central banks are killing them. The ECB is currently killing the German community banks. They will be gone in 5 years' time, sadly, under ECB policies, heavy regulation, massive regulation. They can't afford to hire 5 more people just for filling in forms, and also, of course, the zero interest rate policy and negative yield curve. That's in order to drive them out of business while they're giving money to the big speculative banks. But ultimately, the game plan, as I said, is to get rid of banking entirely and then have only central bank digital currency. And I think we have to fight for our decentralized money creation with decisions locally, because that's one of the questions we need to discuss actually today. Who creates money in this new system? Who's making those decisions and how's that done? And I believe it's best to have decentralized local decision making. Also for governance reasons, you mentioned governance, and these local banks have, you know, accountability to the local community. They're, you know, embedded in the local community. You can't just do a crazy project. That's done by the big banks, because nobody knows what they're doing, not the decentralized small banks.
Let's switch over to Larry, because he's been...
So we have an expression in the US, make it a kiss, or keep it a kiss, which is keep it simple, stupid. If you had a system with no banks, no conventional banks...
So for the translations, so K-I-S-S, kiss, keep it simple, stupid. Sorry, go ahead.
So imagine a world where there was no conventional banks, big banks or small banks, but you just had thousands, tens of thousands of small banks, which are called mutual funds, equity finance mutual funds. If you think about Fidelity Investments, they probably have a couple hundred mutual funds. They're a big, feel like a big holding company, but they have a lot of small banks. Each one of the mutual funds is a relatively small bank. And some of these mutual funds would be taking in money, handing back shares, and investing in environmental projects. So this is a way for people that are interested in the environment to say, okay, I want to buy shares of this particular mutual fund. And if you have that world where everything's 100% equity financed, right away, you don't need this enormous regulatory superstructure that we have at enormous cost. In the US, we probably have 250 different regulatory institutions. You can get rid of all of them because they're all regulating the debt equity ratio of these banks. If you don't have any debt, there's nothing to worry about there. You're not gonna fail ever. But then the other thing is that we'd have a single agency that would do the disclosure so that the mutual fund managers, they buy something, well, that has to be disclosed what it is they're buying. If they're buying a mortgage, then the government has to set up an agency that provides the information about if it's Uli's mortgage, we need to know everything there is about Uli, and it should not, information is a public good. So the government has an immediate role in providing public goods. So just like missile defense is a public good, you wouldn't expect the private sector to do that. You really shouldn't expect the private sector to provide information about whether or not he's actually got a job, because all these different mutual funds are going to bid on his mortgage can use that same information, just like they can all get missile defense simultaneously. So it's not something, information is not something the private sector really can provide well. It needs to be done by the government. So we can have a stable financial system, get rid of all this regulation, have the small players be in the same boat as the large players, because they're all involved in small mutual fund banks, and we can keep the economy stable. And when an economy is stable, then they can have people, when people have jobs and the economy is doing well, then they can start thinking about their children and the long term, and we can start really understanding we need to invest more in the long term, dealing with climate change as part of that. So my guess is that when we had a financial crisis, the concern about climate change became secondary. We had this immediate problem. Let's focus on that. But if we can keep the economy stable, then we can keep the investment in the environment stable as well.
Well, everybody's got, if we have all these little mutual banks invested in long-term green projects, where's the liquidity and what's money?
Who's creating money in your system, in your proposal, with mutual funds? So there's no banks, there's all only mutual funds. But who's creating the money? Because without credit creation or
credit creation, if I need to borrow money, I'll just go to the auction of mutual funds for my mortgage. I'll have,
I'll have this government.
No, it's credit creation. The government is involved in producing high-powered money, it's just like it's always been and will continue to be. And if I need to get credit, let's say it's a consumer loan, I will have my application verified by the Federal Financial Authority, this government agency. They can check me out, and then it goes on to an auction, and the different mutual funds bid for my paper, and I get the best deal. And then whichever mutual fund owns my paper, that's the asset that their shareholders own. So there's credit creation. It's not a central planner. This is an auction. This is a public, a private industry that's...
The money creation bit, though, the high-powered money, you said, that's the only money creation.
The government will create transactions balances, but we can have... that's not really... You know, right now, when you talk about money creation, if you look at M1, the ratio of M1 to reserves is almost 1 in Switzerland. It's not like there's this... You know, this fantastic huge amount of money that's the Swiss banking system has produced that's somehow greasing the wheels of the Swiss economy. That's just not the case.
So then we don't have to abolish it.
It's not working. You know, we almost had Swiss on the
floor. Can we go back to Doug, and then we'll have another question from the floor? Okay, you want to say anything more?
No, I'm done.
Okay.
Mark.
Let's go.
I'm going to speak later, so I'm not going to say more. I think it's been absolutely fascinating. I don't know what the audience makes of this, but it certainly reveals the enormous range of opinions of experts who only agree on one thing, which is that the present system stinks. I have three, I think, very precise questions. They may not be easy to answer. I don't know, for Richard Werner, because I thought I haven't heard him before. I've read his stuff over the years, and I thought it was absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
The first question, and it's pretty obvious, the implication, how exactly do you police whether the financial system, your intended financial system, is lending for financial as opposed to real purposes? That seems to me really very, very hard to do, for reasons which I don't need to explain, so please tell me. Secondly, it's a factual question. I'm not an expert. I think you're talking about the Sparkassen, yes?
And, well, there's 470 Sparkassen, but there's 1,100 cooperative banks. So
my understanding of the relationship, and you're going to correct me, this is the German-specific thing, is that for quite a long time, they have had a significant, and we can discuss how it got there, but a significant excess of deposits over these local loans. They are therefore net lenders to the rest of the financial system, which is itself a massive net lender to the rest of the world. And domestic investment in Germany, corporate investment, has been remarkably weak, as you know. Many economists have spoken on that. So, the question I have, is this a generalizable proposition? My view is that what's kept the German banking system balanced across the whole balance sheet is all the crazy lending elsewhere. So the Spanish, Italian, non-Spanish, American crazy lending is actually just part of the German balance sheet. And you can't treat it as an independent balance sheet. And the final question is, well, money is a public good. Why shouldn't government get the centrage? That's not the same as central planning. I find that very strange notion that for government to get the centrage of creating money, you know, used to happen in the gold standard days, it stamped it. Why is that central planning?
Okay, thank you very much. I'll try to be brief in answer. So the first one, sorry, can you just repeat the first
how
one?
How do you police financial
oh, the policing, sorry,
real,
yes, thank
how
you.
How does the central plan
that's the easiest, and that's the easiest to answer, because we have, of course, national income accounting, and the national income accountants already around 100 years ago when they started with the early national income accounts, they figured this out. So for every transaction, we have a classification, and for every economic activity, there's classifications of how they fit into the economy, and in particular, this distinction between the real economy and the non-GDP transactions has been made because the non-GDP transactions, the financial transactions, the national income accounts will not put into GDP, and therefore they've thought about this. And, you know, it's not very difficult. So anything that's part of GDP is government expenditure, consumption, investment, and all the asset transactions. Essentially, when there's a bank credit creation for purchases of ownership rights, asset purchases. You know, these are the financial transactions, and they're quite easily identifiable. And we have the infrastructure to monitor that and police that, and that is the banking system. So of course, the more decentralized your banking system is, the more you have people on the ground making that decision, and they're doing it in every detail. They're reporting the details to the central banks. Now, they have not always released, well, mostly they don't release these details, but they're all available in the banking system. And we find that the small community banks mainly lend for the real economy. That's how it's been in the past until the most recent ECB policy cycle. And therefore, that's high growth without inflation and without the banking crises. Whereas the more a banking system gets concentrated, the more they do the asset transaction lending, like in the UK, it's essentially most of it, the vast majority, is asset credit based. So the policing is the easiest because that's precisely where the decentralized banking system with many banks, you know, these are the boots on the ground to the policing. And they always ask, you know, when you borrow, you will be asked, what is the money used for? And they will monitor, is it actually used for that transaction? That is part of standard banking. And that's why this can be quite easily done to make sure that we restrict or even abolish bank credit for financial transactions. Let the financial speculators go to mutual funds and capital markets, you know. For this, actually, we don't need a systemic change. We just need the rule that you can only create credit for GDP transactions, or even better, for productive investments. Secondly, as you were saying, there's excess, essentially, excess deposits in the Volksbank, Raiffeisen, and Sparkasse community banking system in Germany, and somehow that is fueling the speculation. Well, I would disagree with this. It is the big banks that, of course, exist also in Germany, Commerzbank, Deutsche Bank, the Landesbank, and have de facto been exactly the same as these big banks. And they've been specializing in the speculative business. They also create money, and that's purely for speculative, or largely for speculative purposes. And that's created these excess balances in the German system that have then sloshed around. And of course also gone to other countries. And the third one on seniorage, well, seniorage technically is the money that is made by those who create money, who issue money. And when we talk about cash, these are the central banks. In some countries they're government owned, but in many countries of course they're privately owned, and that's a bit strange. But when banks create money, they get the interest margin, the margin between the interest they pay the depositors and the interest they charge the borrowers. Now, some people say, oh, we'll just call that seniorage. Technically, that's not seniorage, but let's just call it a profit of the money system. And so who should get that? Well, I think that is a very important question. We should discuss this. I think it should go to those who run decentralized, not-for-profit stakeholder banks, because they're the margins actually the slimmest, the finest margins you can imagine. And they need this to survive and just run their banks for the benefit of their local communities. Whereas with other banks, when you have not these stakeholder banks, but large banks with shareholders, profit maximization, then I think, yes, that's a bit strange that they get all these profits from speculative credit creation, which actually harms society. So I think the important thing is we should make this distinction between the big banks doing speculative lending and the small banks, local banks doing the productive lending, and they should be the latter, the small banks, Volksbank, Raiffeisen, community banks, they should be encouraged and supported.
Thank you. Any of you would like to make a comment here?
I don't think big means speculative. I think Fidelity Investments is a huge mutual fund company. I don't think anybody would say they're a big speculator or that the mutual funds, which are, it owns a lot of small banks inside it, in effect, these equity finance mutual funds. I don't think that when all the American workers who are putting their money in these different stock and mortgage and bond funds and REITs, real estate investment trusts, are viewing themselves as speculating. And these mutual funds have managers who are trying to find good investments, just like your particular, nonprofit banks in Germany. So I don't think, there's the bad guys and the good guys. I think we need to have one system that makes sense, and that if we say, oh, well, we have this precious nonprofit sector, and we have to keep the entire banking system the way it's been, and screwing up for decades and centuries, really, because we need to preserve this particular feature, I think that's kind of putting something before the...
So you're saying we should not distinguish between the big and the small banks, but Bill...
No, because everything would be a small bank.
It's not so simple.
I propose everything's
it's
a small
bit
bank.
More complex.
They're all mutual funds, they're all small banks. They're all small banks.
Mutual funds are not banks. Well, and your proposal means that
mutual funds
banks
are intermediaries. That's what a bank is.
Let's have another question. Can we have another question from the floor?
Not magic fingers.
Alexander? Yes, thank you.
We heard that we need radical thinking to bring the banking system into the future, but I think we also have a past to deal with, which consists of a lot of debt, currently at $230 trillion. And on the other side, we have something like $30 trillion in M1 globally. And I ask many people how we can pay back these debts with so little money, and I couldn't get a decent answer till now. And I think we won't reach the future if we don't deal with this past. Do you have any ideas?
It's not my job to answer, but I want to clarify a point that I think has really helped me with respect to your question, so perhaps it'll help you also. And this is the image. Most of us can get our handle around $1 million. Here in Switzerland, it's not even such a great house. But we can, $1 million you can sort of figure in your mind, right? Okay, so if you were to spend $1 million every single day, 365 days of the year, in what year would you have had to start so that by today you would have spent $1 trillion? You can get your calculators out, I'll help you. It's 500 years before Christ. That's one, and we're talking over 200. Gentlemen, does that help?
Yes.
Go ahead, Bill.
This goes back to something that Martin said right at the beginning, which is the only thing we're agreed on is that we know what we don't like. And the current system, the way that it's operated, I mean, as Bill pointed out at the end of his presentation, has basically been sort of allowing, inciting debt to grow decade after decade. And I guess what one concludes is that we know that in the end, although we've kicked the can down the road successfully so many times, we know logically that this has to end at some point. And I guess the worry that I have at the moment is that we may have gotten to the point where we really should be worried about a moment of transition. So the debt levels globally, in fact, we think about the crisis period as a period of deleveraging, but it hasn't been a period of deleveraging. It's been a transfer, basically, of this incentive to increase debt from the advanced market countries to the emerging market countries. And if you look at the global debt ratios, they've gone, I think at the end of 2007, from 192% of global GDP, they're now 232% of GDP. We've never actually resolved, okay, in the sense of putting behind us, the previous debt problems. We've just added to them, and successfully. So this issue about how do you resolve the question of the debt, how do you make the transition to a new system, I think is enormously important. And I haven't thought my way through it. The only point that I do know is that moments of transition, whether it be regulation or other changes in the system, are always enormously dangerous. And we should be thinking very seriously about how we deal with your problem. And every time I say this to... Every time I say this to people that manage money, you know, whether it's sort of mutual funds, Fidelity, big banks, whatever, basically say, we actually have to have solvency laws that allow you to write off these debts that will never be serviced. I mean, you can hear the sort of the gasps and the... People don't want to talk about it, but it is the elephant in the room, both public and private, and we have to deal with it.
Can it just...
Larry, I think we need to clarify the notion here of debt. I mean, there's leverage in the financial system, which doesn't really change the economy's net worth. Somebody's debt is somebody else's asset. But then there's also the issue of fiscal debt and other kinds of off-the-books debts, you know, fiscal policy, generational policy. And it's absolutely the case that we have, at least in my country, the true fiscal gap, the difference between all the spending obligations, whatever you call them, whether you call it return principal plus interest on some government bond, or whether you just call it a Social Security benefit payment or a health care benefit payment, the whole path of spending has a present value, and the whole path of taxes are projected has a spending value. And the present value of these different paths, the difference between these two paths is about $200 trillion. It's about 20 times the official debt. So most of our obligations are off the books. So your question really comes down to, can the government print enough money, whether electronically or in terms of just physical currency, to come up with $200 trillion? It can't without producing hyperinflation. That's a tried and true statement. We had 20 hyperinflations in the last century. And we're not going to be able to deal with this problem that way. What we needed to have was a big tax hike. We just saw something that, that did not produce that in our country. So we're leaving a bigger problem to our kids, because this $200 trillion problem is getting bigger by $6 trillion a year. That's the true deficit. So that's going to require real structural changes, real damage to some generations over others, a real sacrifice, and we're not discussing that. And this is why the country, our country, is heading to second-rate status through time, because we're not really dealing systematically with the long run.
What's the role of banks in this? What's the role of banks in this, in the creating all this debt? And it's just 1 minute on this. Think of developing countries, and Bill mentioned the debt crisis we've had in many emerging markets and developing countries. They've been piled, huge debt, international debt, has been piled onto them, because essentially they've been encouraged by the Washington institutions to borrow from abroad in foreign currency. And the idea is, oh, they don't have enough savings, they don't have enough money for growing, the big international banks will lend them the money. And this was done. Now, the truth of the matter is, and professor of international banking, the rules of international banking are such that all the dollars they've borrowed, and the pound sterling they've borrowed, and the euros they've borrowed, never entered their own country at all. It never got there. So if they borrowed abroad, say, pound sterling from London, 500 million for South Africa, and then the South African finance minister says, well, actually, we'd like to spend some of that at home in South Africa. And they tell Barclays, oh, can you sort of change that? Oh, no problem, we'll exchange that for South African Rand for you. Where does Barclays get the South African Rand from? It calls their correspondent bank in South Africa and says, you know, we would like to do a deal, sell £500 million sterling, buy South African Rand, what's a good rate, they shop around, they agree. Now, where does the South African bank get the money from? It created out of nothing. So, actually, the lender banks borrowed the money from the developing countries, from their banks locally. It was all a big con. That's how they got indebted. Their assets and their resources were the collateral, so that the foreign lenders, which is creating, well, getting the local banks to create the money,
that's what he's for.
They got control over these developing countries. And were the community banks doing this? No. In fact, these developing countries who've been told how to set up their banking system, decentralized with local stakeholder community banks, this problem would have never happened.
All right.
It's the big international banks that did this, and that's why we do need to distinguish between the big bad guys and the good local guys. It is, you know, that complicated that we have to distinguish between them.
Okay. I'm afraid that's it, because we need to give time to Martin Wolf. Now, realize, the end of the day, we've got a long session, and please remember your questions. Okay, so if you don't think you can remember them, write them down. There are pens in front of you. You have paper. Write them down, all right? We're going to be here for a while, so relax. Thank you. Thank you very, very much.